Okay, we're going to the next area. We've dealt with a lot, you know, going through archaeology in reference to the Old Testament, in reference to interpretation, in reference to history and geography. Talked about Jesus and archaeology. I decided to do this one with archaeology and the early church. And by that, I mean starting with the book of Acts and working all the way to the book of Revelation, but not including it. And plan on next time, assuming it happens, to talk about archaeology in the book of Revelation. And it's got some interesting stuff in there. So anyway, archaeology in the early church is what we're going to be doing. And I've sort of got this worked out to follow some kind of sense of a chronological line, you know, some chronology of things when they happen. But I can't include all the things that I might want to include. We'd be here for several hours. So I've picked out some of the more interesting to me. I'm going to start with the time after Jesus has ascended. Basically, we'll be at that at the very end of this. And then moving through the apostles and the early church in Israel and how they begin to grow. I don't go into Peter and others' ministries that did happen, but I focus on the Apostle Paul and his travels and finally end up at the end of it all with some information that is not directly related, but it will be interesting. So, we're talking about Jerusalem, Temple Mount, and the baptism in the Holy Spirit. Now, I thought I'd start out with something interesting to me, because for so long I've had people say certain things, and you wonder why nobody ever catches it. There is one more subtle point that I'll be talking about that you wouldn't catch unless you're reading the Greek text and understood something about Greek grammar as you read it. But besides that, which is a very subtle, and I'll point it out to you, but this should have been caught if we were careful. But I always tell my students, read slower. There is no prize given to you for reading fast. You know, it's just like we used to do as kids in school. You know, who can read the most chapters? And, you know, it was lightning speed they were reading. You know, they were barely seeing the words as they were turning the pages and counted the chapters to get a prize. We don't get special kudos from God because we can read the Bible really, really fast. We need to read it slowly and think about it as we do. That's one thing I'm trying to do with the Visual Study Bible that some of you have now, is to get you to read the Bible slowly, chapter by chapter, and as you read it, look and see what it's talking about. See the picture, see the video, see the... So when you're reading verse by verse through the New Testament and the Old Testament, you actually begin to understand what the text is discussing. And we've got to slow down, and we will, if you work on it, you can read the Bible several times in your lifetime and read it slow. All right? So I'm going to show you something here that ends with Christ's ascension. And we're looking at a passage in Acts chapter 1. There is a statement that says, in my first book, and that's Luke, O Theophilus, I wrote about all that Jesus began to do and teach until the day he was taken up to heaven, after giving instructions through the Holy Spirit to the apostles he had chosen. And why I have these things in black is to draw your attention to it. Who's being addressed here? The apostles, not everybody. This is not the 500 mentioned at another time. This is another scenario. He's talking specifically to the how many? 11 now, because he lost one. You know that one. You know that story, right? And he's going to have to pick up one more to match the 12 tribes of Israel, match the number that he used before, and we find that happening. So let's look at the bold face. That's the reason I made it that way. To the apostles he had chosen. After his suffering, he presented himself to them, not everybody here. Now, he may have to other, but he's focusing on the 11, to them with many convincing proofs that he was alive. He appeared to them over a span of 40 days and spoke about the kingdom of God. And while they gathered together, he commanded them, do not leave Jerusalem, but wait for the gift the Father promised. So he's giving them a specific order. Stay in Jerusalem, because the Father has promised something to you. For the gift the Father promised, wait for it, which you have heard me discuss. For John baptized with water, but in a few days, you, doesn't say everybody in the world, you will be baptized with the Holy Spirit. When they came together, they asked him, Lord, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? Because he had been talking about it for 40 days. But he said, Jesus replied, it is not for you to know times or seasons that the Father is fixed by his own authority, but you will receive power when the Holy Spirit comes upon you, and you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth. After he said this, they, that is the yous in the text, were looking intently into the sky as he was going, when suddenly two men dressed in white stood beside them. And with guess what the angel said? Everybody here, all 500 of you, know, men of Galilee, that specifically refers to the apostles. Men of Galilee, they said, why do you stand here looking into the sky? This same Jesus who has been taken from you into heaven will come back in the same way you have seen him go into heaven. Then they, guess who that's talking about? We've got a continuity here. But they, that is the 11, returned to Jerusalem from the Mount of Olives, which is near the city, a Sabbath day journey away. When they arrived, they went to the upper room where they were staying. And guess what? I put the you here and the they. Peter, John, James, Andrew, Philip, Thomas, Bartholomew, Matthew, James, Simon the Zealot, and Judas, son of James. That's it. These are the ones. With one accord, they, referring back to these people, all continued in prayer along with the women and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and with his brothers. Now, here a problem develops in the text. Because you've added people to the they, and the you, and the 12, or however the 11, or what do you want to say? They had a few people, women and Mary, the mother of Jesus, with his brothers, and a few other people. Therefore, it is necessary to choose one of the men, he says, when I skipped ahead, because we move to the next discussion. He's going to choose somebody to fill the slot that was left by Judas. And you can read this. Notice we have the word us now. Beginning from John's baptism at the time Jesus was taken away up from us. Who's the us? The ones that he had just been talking about. For one of these must become a witness with us of his resurrection. They proposed two men, Joseph called Barsabbas, also known as Justice, and Matthias, and they prayed. And we find out who was chosen. It was Matthias. Now let's keep on going down. Then they cast lots, and the lot fell to Matthias, and so he was added to the 11. So now they have 12. Now, I say all that to say this. So many people say that the 120 were filled with the Spirit on the day of Pentecost, and it wasn't. It was the 12. There is no baptism of the Holy Spirit with the 120 in the text at all. And yet people regularly read it that way. Even though the only reference to them is a smaller portion and everything else, including the antecedents, go to the 12. Does that make sense to you? People need to read carefully. There's other stories like this in the Bible where people read much too fast and they miss the whole story. You sort of have to work on it. This site I'm giving you right here is the traditional and may well be the accurate site of the house of Mary. This is not Mary, the mother of Jesus, Mary of James and John. Mary, and this may be the site of the upper room. But if it is, I want to point out to you something very difficult to have happened. For thousands of people to gathered right here and saw the tongues of fire and heard the speaking in tongues. Do you see the problem? You couldn't fit in a few dozen, much less thousands, who were listening, and who would have been attracted to something going on in a room up there unless they broke out the windows and were screaming out the windows. It just is not a credible idea. I'll show you what probably is what happened. And it's not that hard to figure out once you dispel some of these other ideas. You have 12 people who were baptized in the Spirit, flames of fire, speaking in other languages that people that we're going to find out a lot of people knew what they were, because they were real languages instead of some things that happened in some certain circles. But I just wanted to spell this. This is not likely a scenario to fit what people talk about. Now, notice when you get to chapter 2 of the book of Acts. After this 120 meet for an evening, have a good time together, then the apostles, as they did every time, if you'll read the text, it says they were continually in the temple praising and blessing God. What does that mean? They went to, Jesus said, wait to Jerusalem, all right, until the Spirit comes. Don't leave. Stay there. And every day they went to the temple and they prayed and worshiped God. Not an upper room. They slept there, had a little dinner there, met some people. But their activity was in the temple. Now, it becomes important for understanding certain things. There was what we call a temple mount. On the temple mount were lots of buildings. Not just the temple itself, but other buildings that related to the temple. You also had temple retaining walls that we have now that were knocked over by the Romans, except for, you know, as you went down. The upper area was knocked down, and I'll show that to you at the end of the story here. But the temple retaining walls isn't the temple. The floor is not the temple. And the other buildings is not the temple. But they sometimes use the word temple to refer to the temple mount, and sometimes the temple itself. You'll find people using that terminology in the text. Okay? So you sort of have to see the context of what's being said to understand it. Remember Matthew 24, after Jesus had been on the temple mount with his disciples, coming across the Kidron Valley to the Mount of Olives, and they said, my, aren't there beautiful buildings on the temple mount? Right? And Jesus said, not one of these buildings will stand that's on the Temple Mount. But they didn't destroy everything. They just destroyed the buildings, largely. You understand me? In Matthew 24, they're referring to all these beautiful buildings. Not just the temple itself, but everything relating to it. And one of the buildings is something I'm going to show you in a minute. And the reason why we can say this is probably what it looked like is because Herodian, our architecture, way of doing things, looked like how Romans did it. And probably they would have followed the same pattern based on what we know. And I'll show that to you in a minute. But let's keep reading this. And so, and when the day of Pentecost came, that's the 12, now we got one more, suddenly came a sound like a mighty rushing wind came from heaven and filled the whole house where they were sitting. Now, the word house here is a word which means a dwelling or place that you are not necessarily inhabiting and living, but a location. And you'll see that that's so because, remember, at this point, they're on the Temple Mount. And there are on the Temple Mount, in what is known as Solomon's Portico, an area that was used for rooms that people stayed. That don't mean they lived there, but they spent time there. And that's probably what we're referring to here in the text. Notice that they were sitting and not standing. What would be the difference? I always like to inquire. I know nobody's ever going to answer me, but maybe you can't hear it on the telecast that way. But the thing is, standing was for prayer. Sitting was for teaching. That's how they did it. They stood for prayer. They sat for teaching. So when it says that they were sitting, they were not upstanding and doing something like this. They were sitting down listening to something being said. And while they were sitting and listening to something being said, the Spirit came with flames of fire upon each one of the 12. Right? And so we see that. And it says, it rested on them, and they, these 12, were all filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak in other tongues as the Spirit enabled them. And then there was dwelling in Jerusalem. The word dwelling is referring to they were staying there right then. Doesn't say how long. Didn't mean they built a house or bought it one. They were dwelling and actually existing. When I've been on trips sometimes, I've dwelt in cities by staying in a hotel. It's not my home. It's not even a house, but it's a place I was staying right now. So it says that there was dwelling in Jerusalem God-fearing Jews Now, this is where these God-fearing Jews are from. Every nation under heaven. Now, they're not thinking of the Americas at this point. Do you realize that? The world was basically the Roman Empire for all practical purposes. And so, from all these various nations, and I'm going to show you some places of these nations, and I wish I could show them all to you. I've actually started making a collection of pictures of all these various things and what these people came from. But I'm only going to show you, to me, one of the, maybe the best tonight. I couldn't turn it down. I just want to show it to you. I love the place. So, it says there were God-fearing Jews. So let's keep that in mind, from every nation under heaven. And when this sound went out, a crowd came together in bewilderment because each one heard them speaking his own language. Now, I don't know how much Hebrew these people knew, but they knew their own language where they were in the diaspora, whether it be Greece or maybe in Babylonia or wherever they were. They knew the language of the people they lived with for years and years since the diaspora. Not everybody came back to Jerusalem with Nehemiah and Zerubbabel and all these people. I mean, Ezra and so forth. A lot of them actually stayed where they were. They had homes built. They lived there. They had families there. They had all sorts of marriage going on. They stayed where they were. And they kept speaking their own language there. And maybe they kept some Hebrew too. Who knows? But the point of it is they did understand these other languages because they were from the other countries and these were legit languages. Now, I grew up with, I don't want to go into it too much, but I grew up with a situation that people spoke in tongues all the time, but nobody ever knew anything that was ever said. So, but here these people actually knew it because the languages were genuine languages, okay, not just a so-called prayer language. Now, keep that in mind, dwelling in Jerusalem, God-fearing Jews. You've got to keep that in mind, read the text, and keep it in your head. From every nation under heaven, when this sound rang out, there was a sound that got attention. Astounded and amazed, they asked, are not these men who are speaking Galileans? Remember what the angel said to the 11? Men of Galilee. Matter of fact, even the whole thing with Peter in the garden what was the guy's name? I know it so well. Not Josephus. Help me. Huh? Caiaphas's house. Yes, thank you. I go there all the time with tour groups. You'd think I remember all the time. Anyway, Caiaphas's house, the fact is, in the garden, this man sounds like a Galilean. Why? Because he was from Galilee. Jesus picked all his guys from the Galilee, except maybe for Matthew. I think Matthew may be different there. I'd have to check. But essentially, they were Galileans. Are these not speaking who are Galileans? How is it that each of us hears them in our own native language? And then he mentions these countries, Parthians, Medes, Elamites, residents of Mesopotamia, Judea. There were some in Judea. Cappadocia, which I'm going to show you pictures of. Pontus, Asia, Phrygia, Pamphylia, Egypt and the parts of Libya near Cyrene, visitors from Rome. They came all over the place. To what? The Feast of Pentecost. This is what Jews did. They went to feast. Now, both Jews and converts to Judaism, Cretans and Arabs, we hear them declaring the wonders of God in our own tongues. Astounded says, what does this mean? Others mocked. They are drunk on new wine. Now, here's the problem. All of these others, they hear all these languages and they say, I understand what they're saying. They're declaring the wonderful works of God. Now, if you'll notice, he does not say they are preaching. They are giving what is called in Jewish thought, it's called declarative praise. You had praise expressed in two ways. One is called declarative, where you declare his works. And the other is descriptive, where you declare his character. You talk about God's character with descriptive praise. You talk about God's activities and his works with declarative praise. This is the way it was. So when you read this, it's very clear, if you understand that these people that were speaking in tongues were speaking actually declarative praise, talking about the wonderful works of God. They were not preaching to the people. They were not saying unintelligible languages. They were saying God's praise in front of the people. That's what's going on. Now, but notice both Jews and converts to Judaism, we hear them declaring the wonders of God in our own tongues. But then you have another group. And it says, others mock them saying, they're drunk. Why would they say they're drunk? Because they can't understand a word. To them, it's gibberish. Why? Because you have two groups expressed there. Those that are dwelling in Jerusalem, generally, who are there for the feast from other countries, and Judeans who happen to live in Jerusalem. Judeans didn't get the language to understand it. It was foreign languages, and they thought they're drunk. The others think they make a lot of sense because they're speaking in real languages. And interestingly, in the Greek, you have two statements. In Greek, there are two forms of words. One is called other of the same sort, and that's the word alos. And the other is called others of a different source, and that is heteros. And which one you see? The ones here, and it says they, these others, said they are drunk, are the heteros, the others of a different sort. In other words, they don't fit the same classification. And he is distinguishing in the text that you have two decisive groups of people, the local Judeans and those from other countries for the feast. You understand that? That's what's going on in the text here. People get this all screwed up. Now, Peter stood up with the 11 and said, men of Judea and all who dwell in Jerusalem, two different groups. Remember he said the others dwelling, the others who are coming from these other countries were dwelling in Jerusalem? He said that earlier, a few verses formerly. And now he uses the same statement. They're the Judeans and those that are from the diaspora coming to the feast. And those are the two groups that are going through the experience. Listen to my words. These men are not drunk as you suppose. And then reading all the stuff, they say, we are witnesses. Well, anyway, that's a fascinating story here to understand. And the fact is, we know from reading the text and also analyzing the circumstances at the time that we do not have 120 people receiving the filling of the Spirit on the day of Pentecost. We know that there were 12. And they did it by coming to the temple every day instead of in some upper room someplace, which nobody would ever come to or hear from the temple. At the temple area during the feast, guess what? There were thousands of people roaming around up on the Temple Mount. Anybody who's been on top of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem? You can fit thousands of people roaming around on that place and have plenty of room. It's a big, big, big place. You couldn't fill hardly 20 or 30 people in an upper room, okay, to do anything. So we got to get ideas out of our head by reading more carefully. Does that make sense to you? I hope that helps a little bit on understanding this passage, particularly when people look at it. Because we're going to talk about the Temple Mount here a little bit, and we've already talked about the fact of the 12 being there basically every single day waiting for the coming of the Spirit as Jesus had commanded them. So we see here the Temple Mount, a portion of it. This is the southern wall at the bottom that you can see to the left. And it's in disrepair, it looks like. But I'm going to say what you have out there that you don't see right now are some very important things that we're going to discuss and show you. Okay? And then there's the southern steps. And the holy gates, there were three of them, and you could come through those to go down. If you were to go in the days of Jesus and the early church, when you went through those gates, you went down into an area that now is a mosque underneath that, and you go up the stairs right onto the Temple Mount through what they call the mosque they have there. Okay? So things have been changed somewhat from 2,000 years, but essentially the same structure is there. Alaska Mosque is there, but that used to be the same location as something I'm going to tell you about. Okay? Now, if you look on the left, this long structure is clearly in Roman format. Matter of fact, it looks like a lot like what you see in Athens that was the place of the Stoics. Philosophers, and they call it today the Stoa, S-T-O-I-A. If you were in Athens looking down from the Acropolis, You would see the stoa in what is now the big agora, the big marketplace. That's the public marketplace. Down the street, that's a government marketplace. Down the street from there, if you actually are in Athens and go down a few blocks, there is what was, they found the public agora, a public marketplace and one that was more connected to the civil stuff of the city, right? Right next to the Acropolis. Now, they're built about the same. So why do I say this is probably like what it looked? Because they basically built these porticos looking this way in the ancient world. We have information about that. So this is a stoa called Solomon's portico or porch. This, we're basically sure. I mean, it's not a lot of doubt on it. That this is the large structure that would have been on the side, on the southern wall where the Al-Aqsa Mosque is now, that actually had lots of rooms in it, that probably one of which the apostles were having their teaching sessions every morning. Okay? Now, what happened is that when the Spirit came, first of all, what happened? There was a large, large sound. That would get attention. Don't you hear a sonic boom? You wonder where it comes from? They didn't have those often in those days. When this massive sound took place, like a rushing mighty wind, people are going to get attention. What is that? What is that? Right? And they start going toward the sound. The next thing that happens is visible. Tongues like fires, right? On the top of each one of the 12. People were attracted in there. That's where the apostles probably were. And that's where the speaking in tongues occurred. Now, Peter has an audience now, so what does he do? He probably gets out in the midst of them where they can all hear him to talk. And what did he do? He became a witness. He told about David and Jesus and his resurrection. He went through the whole gospel story to give them so that they would embrace the Messiah. And what do we find out? Upwards of 3,000 accepted Jesus as Messiah that day with the proclamation of Peter. It's not the tongues that caused them to be saved. That got attention and wonderment, but it was a message that Peter spoke afterwards that was based on that phenomena ahead of time. Does that all make sense to you? So this is likely the kind of structure that you see. This is found in a lot of ways in which people work it. This is another piece of artwork that's been done. If you'll see the particular walkway up, and there's a long bridge that goes across, that's the western wall of the temple. If you go to Israel and see where this place is, that's all gone. Matter of fact, I was with, and I'll show you a picture in a moment. I was with the archaeologist that actually excavated this area. His name is Ronnie Reich. And so I spent several hours with him there, and we talked about the things, and he said one thing to me I thought was pretty fascinating. He said, this particular structure, these structures there of the walls, he said that was cleaved in half, and it fell in one whack downward and crushed the walks below. And I don't know how they know that, but I assume that he's much more knowledgeable of this area than I am. And so he said when they broke that, the Romans did, they cleaved it in half somehow and let it fall. And if you look below there, you see the structures that have been of heavy, heavy stone that has just been just knocked in really, really deep. And then, of course, they dissembled the upper areas of the retaining wall, and that's where we have the western wall today, and that's where the stones fell if you're in the southwestern portion that I would point with a pointer if I had one. Now, so when you look at that, realize that the buildings that were on top, which were more buildings than what we have up there now, were all demolished totally. And this kind of stone they had, limestone, burns. That's why they set this afire, and it pretty well burned it all up. It didn't leave anything behind. You don't think of stone really burning, but apparently this does very hot. And so all those structures on top of the temple are gone, and then portions of the retaining wall. Here's another look at it to give you a feel. So this is an area that you actually went into, probably Solomon's stoa, or I say stoa because of Greece, Solomon's portico. And you walk up there, and you can walk down. And of course, underneath that, even today, if you go to Jerusalem, how many have been to this place? You've seen it. When you go here, what you observe is this. You have the wall here, which is the western wall, and then you have little shops here. And there used to be more than that. And then they found even a key, by the way, stuck in an opening above one of these when they were doing the excavation. There's a little key that apparently fit into probably a wooden door that was up against one of the little shops. And, you know, you lock it and bring it. And, you know, if you'd have been looking, you'd have found it, and you could get into a shop. You know how it works in your house? They put it under the rug. People look there first, you know. So, anyway, the point is, if you go to Jerusalem, you see all sorts inside the city, all these market shapes, right? Most of these stores are little stores. And people sell their goods. It's the same way in the ancient world. So Jesus would have walked on those particular stones. A lot of time when I'm on tours, I say, we're walking today where Jesus walked, 30 feet above, because it has built up over all those years. But when you're here, you're actually walking on the same time period. So Jesus did walk there, if that's important to you. So you can go here, and that's the structure of the ancient temple. By the way, when you look at the temples of the ancient world, I'm talking about at the Acropolis, I don't care which city you want to go to, the Jewish temple was magnificent in comparison to anything else. And the structure of the Temple Mount far exceeds anything in the Greco-Roman world. It really does. It was a marvel of the world. And Herod, they call him a builder, and he was. He was a terrible, terrible man personally. But he really liked to build things, and they have remained around pretty much what he built because he was... He probably watched it very carefully to make sure it was done right. Here's something for you for Herod. If you go to the Herodium, anybody know what the Herodium is? Okay, it's outside of Bethlehem in Jerusalem. Herodian, when he had that built originally, he said it's not high enough. So he had the guys to cut off about a third of a hill right next to it and take all that and put it on top of the new one, Herodium. I mean, that's what he did. I mean, he had the manpower. Nobody debated him. They just did it. And so he actually built the Herodium to be much taller than everything else around because he said, I want that part of the hill taken off and put over here. So here you have a structure that they're building. This is done by a man by the name of Leon Rittmeyer. He's an archaeologist. He did about 15 years working on the temple itself and all of his architectural matters, and fascinating guy, written a book just on the area that he spent all these years working on his dissertation at Hebrew University. And so he really knows this area very well. And this is something he laid out for all the gates that went into the temple, the Antonia Fortress at the end. It was a little small thing. Some people are trying to argue today. Somebody came to me the other day with this, and I said, listen, please don't talk about that, because nobody who knows anything about archaeology would give any confidence in what's being said. Because there are some guys who don't know anything about archaeology at all who go around and write books and do movies, but they're clueless. There's one guy, I won't mention names on the air here, but there's one guy who did this. He went to Saudi Arabia to find the new Mount Sinai because the old ones in the Sinai Peninsula couldn't be true. It has to be across the Persian Gulf and over in Saudi Arabia. So he takes and writes out 10 things on a piece of paper that he must find to prove his viewpoint, goes over there with a forged passport, interestingly enough, and spends 2 weeks looking for all the evidence of 10 pieces on his piece of paper, finds every one of them within 2 weeks, goes back, does a movie. Archaeologists would love to find one or two things in months, less 2 weeks. But to find it all and say, well, I found all the evidence, is somewhat construed. It's about the same level of a guy called Ron Wyatt who claimed to have the Ark of the Covenant at home. And he just hadn't shown it to anyone because people would want it and stuff, you know. Anyway, I wouldn't follow those guys. Okay. But these are the great way to look at what's there. You notice the portico is still there on this. It's always there because we have the evidence, and El Ascamas is taking some of it up right now. Okay. Well, I don't know who that guy is, but there's an area of Cappadocia. Now, I take a lot of trips to Turkey, as well as all the 40-something trips I've done to Israel over the years, and live there some too. But I love to go to Turkey, and I've been there many times too. Usually I don't go to this place because it takes an extra day or two unless you want to take an extension, because it's in the center of the country. But this is where there's nothing significant that I know that happened in the time of the New Testament. And maybe there is. But it became important in the times of the second and third century. It's a major, major center of the church. And one thing they have up in this area, they have underground cities you can visit and go underneath the ground, down, 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 and see where people lived, hiding from the Romans and later hiding from the Muslims. Underground cities. And this area here, I'm going to show you some cool stuff. In Cappadocia was one of the places mentioned. The reason I can tie it to our talk tonight is because if you look at the ones from the various nations that came to the feast, it mentions those from Cappadocia. So here we are. It connects. People came from this area, and there's no place on earth like it. There's also another place called Pamukkale, or Hierapolis, near Colossae and near Laodicea, that also has some stuff that you won't see anywhere else, too. But this maybe is the most unique. That's why I want to show it to you. These little gnome-looking places were apparently created somehow by volcanic activity. I don't understand it exactly how it works. But these were used in the days of the second and third century church as places of worship. They had some of the bigger ones were used for churches, smaller ones used for homes. And you find many, many, I've been in a number of them, and you go in and find the church ones, and they have all these beautiful frescoes that have been painted on the walls of these little churches. And some fascinating things. Unfortunately, some people have gone on, and when they see Jesus and some of the other people, they mark out their faces. I can't imagine who would do that, but we could take a guess. But over the centuries, that has happened. But generally speaking, it's not. So there I am amidst the gnome field. Look at this. You can take about 5 o'clock in the morning, get on and do balloon rides all over the place. It covers about 100 miles of these things. And there are balloons. That gives you that one. Here's some more running around the area. You can do balloon rides. They're really fun. Here's one of the frescoes that was done. Really beautiful. You got to consider, you know, the limitations of what kind of equipment and, you know, they had to work with to be able to get in there and produce things of this quality. And a lot of the churches have not only these pictures, but many, many others that are really, really pretty to look at and a place of worship. Now, this is another example. Some of these are very large, some are very small. And this is in Cappadocia. It goes over about 100 miles of this. Mentioned in Acts 2, but the reason I did it, because I like the place. And not many people get a chance to see it. Have you ever seen this? I mean, this is where the Cappadocian fathers came from in the 4th century. In AD 325, the church came up with the argument, contrary to the Arians, and argued that Jesus was not a created being who was an inferior deity. That was being argued by some people because the church had come out of paganism and not everything had gotten straight yet. Let me assure you, look at the church at Corinth. When that church came out of paganism, they didn't make all the right decisions all the time. And that happens sometimes in churches where people are not right on with the theology. That's why Jude says in Jude 3 to contend for the faith, once for all deliver the saints. And he talks about problems. John talks about problems in the book of Revelation. And I suspect in churches today there are some problems like that. So what you find is that at this time, the Cappadocian fathers became important because AD 325, the church developed an orthodox statement called the Nicene Creed. I don't know if you ever read it. It's a very important creed. It's built on the Apostles' Creed that came over the second and third centuries. They came up with correct view, but there were some problems that went on. I want to go into all the stories. One of my degrees in there are patristics and the church fathers. That's one reason I like to sort of talk about this some. The church began to have a debate on whether maybe Arianism was correct and the Nicene Creed was wrong. The Cappadocian fathers who lived in this area were the three major scholars that argued so well against the error that was trying to be reinstituted to defeat it. After 381, a lot of work from these guys here, after 381, it never became an issue ever again. And they wrote another creed, a very important one, and one that somewhat relates to Irina. She likes this one very much because where it was decided was the Church of St. Irina in what we call Istanbul. It used to be called Constantinople. So some fascinating stuff here. Well, let's look then at what happened. After the disciples became all filled with the Spirit, Peter was preaching, 3,000 people came to Christ. Scholars used to have concerns about this. Can it be that actually 3,000 people could have been baptized with a limitation of water that would have been available to do it in Jerusalem? 3,000 people one day? Sounds enormous to me. Remember, they did not sprinkle and pour. They immersed. I always get a kick when people say, I was baptized by immersion. That's like saying I'm immersed by immersion. Sure you are. Baptized is just a made-up word from baptizo, baptismos. It's a created word. So you're actually immersed. You don't have to say it again. Now, but immersion was the practice of the Greek church, the Eastern church, for the whole time until today even. They've always practiced immersion because they actually read Greek. The Latin fathers didn't read Greek. They read Latin and they made up a word and they were able to move away for something besides immersion. So knowing language helps sometimes. But you could, because you know why? They found 30 in the excavations here, after they moved away the rubble, dug up stuff, they found 31 what we would call baptismal pools in the to the south of the southern of the steps. 31 of them. Plenty of water was around. Plenty of water. That whole debate went out the window after that. Because, remember, the Jews had a practice, and I think it's a more sensible practice, quite honestly. That's the way I baptize people today when I'm in the Jordan River in Israel. When I was baptized, they grab you like this, you know, and they run you down and then run you up. And sometimes you get lost because they lose control of their hands and you're floating. Well, and that's especially bad in rivers. But the way they did it, historically, it makes a lot of sense. What happened when baptism occurred, they actually baptized and you went down and you came up. And that's how you immersed yourself. You didn't lie flat and float off. So in these mikvahs, it was easy to do what I just suggested. Because when they baptized the Jews, when they immersed themselves for purification, it was a very familiar rite. They just simply went into the thing, they bent over, they went under the water, they came back up. It was a simple process because they had to do that every time before they went into the Temple Mount for purification. So baptized, as Jesus initiated, was very easy to accomplish for 3,000 people with 12 people doing it. Okay? So that sort of helps here when you work on this. And here I am, must have been in the evening sometime, but in one of the pools, show you sort of how the deep they are, the reason I'm showing you that. And you can go down the steps. There are all these in there on the southern area of the southern steps. So there's a bunch of them I could do. Well, the next thing is just one little thing in Syria. You've heard of the street called Straight. What happened there? Paul the Apostle was involved. He was told to go to see someone and go to a place called the Straight Street. A street called Straight. And here it is, by the way. It's still around. Not everything is destroyed. This was very functional. And because it was, people kept it. And you go through here. Here's one that shows you probably more how it looked before, you know, some damage has occurred over the 2,000 years. Probably more like that. But here's the street. That's why they called it Straight. And so the street called Straight. Well, let's talk about the travels of Paul. The first one is on Cyprus. Now, I can't cover every place tonight. But Sergius Paulus is important for maybe a couple of reasons. One is, this is probably the first convert of the Apostle Paul, you know, that we have evidence in his missionary journey. Secondly, he was a proconsul with Rome, which what you find in the ancient world, it was not uncommon, as we're going to see a couple, it was not uncommon for public officials, and particularly the military, to embrace Christianity. You see that in the New Testament with Cornelius and others like that. You find that in reference to Jesus at Capernaum with the centurion. Why was the military attracted? Because they saw something different in the Christian faith than what they saw in their paganism. And it actually reaffirmed some of their disciplines and ideas in the military. And Rodney Stark at Baylor University, a sociologist, has done a lot of very fine books. But one book he did, he actually traced the development of the Christian faith throughout the Roman world in the first several centuries based on where were the military having their basic structure of their, I want to say camps, but, you know, their garrisons kept. And he found there was a pronounced development of Christians in places that military were. Lots and lots of military did that. And this was reaffirmed in one that I can't show you right now because they're still working on it. But up at near Tel Megiddo in the area of Jezreel, where the Valley of Armageddon is, you know, likely to happen there, they're found in a prisoner's camp for very dangerous people, Arab terrorists. They found when they were digging around there and doing, they found a chapel that was built by a centurion in the 200s. This is 100 years before Christianity became official. In the 200s, a chapel was built. You find on the floor a mosaic. And one of the statements on the mosaic says, it was dedicated to the God Jesus. And you find that you had a Christian movement that actually was happening there, and that was built by the centurion, a chapel. Has a lot of things that would be similar to that. So there's interesting things you begin to come across. But here, I pick this out because here is the first guy Paul gives a gospel to. He does a little thing with Elymas. You know, he makes him blind. That sort of helps to get him out of the way. And then he preaches to this guy, and he becomes a believer. And we don't know for sure, but look at it. He's identified in the text by Luke, who was a Greek. The proconsul Sergius Paulus, an intelligent man, sort of like Theophilus would have been for the Gospel of Luke when Luke wrote a thing to the man Theophilus. Probably the same kind of guy. And he's called Sergius Paulus, but he's identifying Saul, who is also called Paul. Paul assumes from this point on the name Paul rather than Saul. It may be that he actually officially adopted the word Paul because of the convert that he receives here, whose name is Paul. Just a thought, but it's an interesting phenomenon that's occurred here. Here is, in fact, the example. This inscription on the stone mentions it's part of it's rubbed out somewhat over age and things happening, sort of like what happened with the Pontius Pilate inscription in Caesarea Philippi, Caesarea Maritima, by the sea. So it's not all there. Like, this is not all here, but you can figure out it's Sergius Paulus by reading the language. And so this was actually found on Cyprus, referring to the man that is Paul's first convert, talked about in the book of Acts. What about Tarsus? I had my first trip to Tarsus I said, I want to go to Antioch. Well, we really don't do tours to Antioch. Well, I want to go to Antioch, though. I'd like to see it. My guy, who's a good friend now, we've laughed about this, but he set up a tour for me, and he had a guy to lead the tour. So I flew from the west coast of Turkey all the way over to Antioch, which used to be in Syria, but now is in modern Turkey. And so I got there and met the guy, did not speak hardly a word of English. And he took me to things that basically were worthless to look at. He had his ask if his wife and daughter, he sort of got it out to me, could come with us. And we went to shopping, and he wanted me to pay lunch for everybody. had some funny things that occurred on this. I didn't see much at all in Tarsus at all. He showed me one little thing in Tarsus, and he explained that this had something that was old. There is more there than what I found out than what I found out at that day that the guy basically took me. And when I wanted to pay him, he wanted more money. I didn't debate him. I gave him some more cash. He needed to get more hamburgers. And I got on a bus and headed off to Cappadocia. But that's the story. But this right here is a Roman road to Tarsus, to give you an idea about that. These went throughout the empire. These Roman roads were built by soldiers when they weren't out having war. They actually worked. And how did they work? They worked building roads. And that's why we have all Roman roads, thousands of miles of Roman roads in the ancient world. Very helpful spread of the gospel, easier to travel than over the land. And so God worked it out that way to provide a means to spread the gospel more quickly. So the Roman roads. And there's an example of it going to the gate that leads out into Tarsus. I'm not going to say much about Tarsus. I didn't find out a lot about Tarsus because I have a guy who didn't know anything about Tarsus. I actually want to go back to Antioch and Tarsus again sometime. Maybe I'll find another guy. But this actually is from the first century. Paul in Ephesus. Well, there's some really interesting things in Ephesus. Let me talk about them. Ephesus, here is Diocletian, who was an emperor in the early second century. It's sort of broken down now, but you can see the hills around. This is the entrance area into Ephesus, and it goes quite a ways. It's a long road, and I'm showing you not from the beginning of it, but portion way down. You keep on moving down and get closer and closer. The thing you see in the back is a library called the Celsus Library. Unfortunately, Paul the Apostle never had an opportunity to visit this library and use it because it was built about a century after he died. So this is not a first century kind of thing, but it is a fascinating structure. Keeping on moving toward that, though, one finds some other roads we'll talk about. This is just outside of Ephesus to give you a feel for it. This is some of the kind of work that's done, statues around here. This is to the god for luck, to K. Means, you know, good luck. This is also on one of the pavements, and I saw this. You thought that was Nike? I don't think that's Nike, but I may be wrong. You either have Nike or 2K. Pick your one. So if it's Nike, it means victory, rather than 2K, which means luck, I'm for it. Now, notice this is a menorah, and this was found on one of the pavements in Ephesus. And so there was a Jewish population even in Ephesus. Here's the god Artemis. Artemis, the deity, a goddess. You're right? Oh, good. That's fine. But Artemis here, you'll notice this is showing her as a many-breasted one. The reason for this is for she was extremely important in the Greek world as a goddess. Many cities had her as the goddess of the city because she provided sustenance and bounty for the city. She's like the one who gives it out, you know. And so her depiction is that way. She's also found another way, and that is as a person who has a stag, a deer next to her, and she's out. She's a huntress. She hunts. So two different ways people viewed Artemis, also known as Diana in Latin. This is a road which went down to the bay. Unfortunately, you can't go down to the bay today because there's no water there. The water actually readjusted based on earthquakes. The water actually readjusted and has gone out about 10 miles from where Ephesus used to have it. There's still water there. You just have to go 10 miles farther, and you don't have a bay at your city. I never realized that earthquakes could do things like exactly like that, but they do apparently. And so they have actually an ending here. If you walk out to the bay, they have a big thing, you know, that was there one time, and you could get into the boat and go away. It's not there anymore because it's 10 miles more away. But this was Ephesus, a major, major city of the ancient world. And this is where Paul lived for some time, the Ephesian church was. It's also the place that John probably brought Mary, the mother of Jesus. Remember at the cross, he took her in as like a mother? And church tradition has him moving her over to Asia Minor and being in Ephesus. And the evidence is very strong that John actually lived in Ephesus until his death. He went to Patmos for a short time in exile. But the way it worked in the Roman world, when you exile somebody as an emperor, or any kind of edict you make as an emperor, when you cease being emperor, your edicts go away. I don't know if we can make that happen today or not. They just sort of, when you have a crazy president, then you can make him go away by him getting out of office. Today we have requirements to rescind them all. But anyway, in the ancient world, when the emperor died, John moved back to Ephesus. He didn't stay on Patmos. This is the temple of the Emperor Trajan. Oftentimes they glorified other, you know, different emperors that lived. This is the theater that more than 20,000 people sat in this theater one day, and they were all upset about Christianity coming. Paul was having trouble with it. He had a person, a lawyer, who tried to get out in front of these guys and try to talk and calm them down. And they yelled off for, 2 hours? Great is Artemis of the Ephesians. Great is Artemis of the Ephesians. Can you imagine doing that? Maybe they do that today, though, in ball games. Same kind of thing. You know, 20,000 people yelling and screaming the same thing. So that's what they did here in Ephesus. That is a theater. This is the difference between an amphitheater and a theater is that an amphitheater is a coliseum that goes around. A theater just goes about halfway. And this is a Greek one because a Greek theater is always built into the actual lands formation, the curves and so forth. Roman theaters are built upon stilts. They don't need that. They can build them on a flat platform. That's all because they've built it up. It's a little different. This is a theater that had 20-something thousand people actually use that. I just thought I'd show you this in case you need to. They actually had public restrooms in the ancient world. This is one in Ephesus. They actually had they didn't have stereo, so they actually had a slave group that actually in the middle of this goes around, and in the middle of this, you can't see it, they had a place for them to play instruments as people were there, and this was where people did business, listened to music, and so forth. And it's an interesting place. I say Bucky's is much better. All right. Now, this is one of they have a lot of these in the walkways, the streets in Ephesus. You see a number of different kinds. This is one. It's obviously a game of some sort. Even as what happened to my other game? Did I lose my other game? I guess I threw it away. Okay, I had another game also that they did that looked more like checkers. But they did this on, and people played these. This right here is the first ever painting of the Apostle Paul that's ever been found. Now, very few people get to see this because when you go there, they don't take you to this. You walk up the mountain a ways, you go to a cave, you go into this wonderful frescoes on the wall. This is one of them of Paul and Thecla. Notice Palos is his name there. Over to the right, you see the woman. Her name is Thecla. It's thought that the woman in the building is probably Mary. That's what it's thought. We don't know. But we do know that's Thecla. And there is actually a book you can read that was found by the church fathers. It's called Paul and the Acts of Thecla. So she was a noted person in church history. But these are the picture of that. And it's inside a cave. But you have to get special permission to know certain people to get in. A little look at the city around. This is the entrance into. That's where you start really getting to see the city when you walk through there. This is Corinth, looking from Acro, Corinth. Now, you may wonder about. I did at first. I thought, why do they call it Acro, Corinth? You find out Acro is a high hill around. And we have what is called the Acropolis, the Acropolis. You heard that, right? Acropolis means high city. Polis in Greek is city. Acro means high, it's high city. And in here in Corinth, they don't call it Acropolis because they already had an Acropolis in Athens. So they just call it the Acro Corinth, the High Corinth. Below, you see the Corinth, the Temple of Apollo to the left. You see a lot of things around there. That was the ancient city of Corinth where it was located. And they're looking from the other angle back up at the hill where I took the picture for the other thing. So this was taken, that was taken from the big hill, and this is the big hill from the below. Okay. This is a street that was part of the Roman circuit of roadways. This is called the Via Ignatia, the Ignatian Way. Went throughout the empire out of here out of Corinth. You went through the big, so like here in Houston, you know, you move through Houston on to other states, and same thing here. And this is where it's thought maybe about where that building is, just a little bit, not quite to the building, if you could get close to it. They think that maybe where the synagogue was. And if you look in some of these, they actually found some tent makers materials, and it's about, 3 or 4 of those on this side down the way when they were doing excavation. They found tent makers. That could have been where Aquila and Priscilla and Aquila were. They were tent makers. Paul joined them there in Corinth. So that's possible. At least they were tent makers who ever worked there. But this street is fascinating. This is a public bath. They like to take baths. I'll just stop it there. And something here, if you look, and I can't point it out to you, but if you look over here, there's an inscription on that first column, and it says in Greek, Seneca. And Seneca was a very famous Stoic writer and public figure. And his brother was Gallio, who was a proconsul in Rome. Very important person. And not Seneca, but his brother Gallio, when he lived here, is the one who actually officiated when the Jews were trying to get Paul arrested. And Gallio let him go free. And he went after the Jews instead of Paul. That's what the biblical text talks about. And it's Seneca's brother, Gallio, who did it when he was officiating here. So that's sort of interesting historically about the law. Paul got off because of Gallio. They did not cut off people's arms and legs. What they did, these are called votive offerings. Votive offerings are ones you dedicate to the deity when you're asking him to heal you, particularly in the religion of what is called Asclepius. Asclepius has a major shrine, the Asclepian, at the foot of a place in Pergamum, which is on the one of the churches of the seven churches of Asia. And you can go to the Asclepian, but they had Asclepian locations. That was the major one. But they had them all over the Roman world. He was the god of healing. And that snakes went around. And that became the medical symbol that even people today use. That came from Asclepius, the god of healing, and he had these oaths and the way they dealt with people and so forth. But what people would do is they would, if they had an injury on, you know, a nose or a hand or a foot or even other body parts, whatever it may be, you would make something like it, and then you would take it to the temple and you would offer it as an offering to the god to heal you of that problem. So, for example, they have just about everything you could imagine there, and I won't go into them all. But here's a funny one that was found. I found this. It was in a library, in a museum. Somebody's ears. Dedication of body parts to Asclepius. So if you're having ear trouble, you make an ear and you take it to the temple and pray for Asclepius to take care of your ear problem. Might work just as well as some of the stuff we get today. This is the Temple of Apollo. By the way, the Apollo, and I was going to have a section here I can't think of the name of it. Delphi. I was going to do a thing on Delphi because it's a great thing. I always take people to that. Most tours do Athens, do Corinth, and they're gone. But they really miss something if they don't go to Delphi, because Delphi is also connected to Corinth and the god Apollo. It's the shrine of Apollo. It's where the oracle of Delphi was, who spoke in tongues, unintelligible tongues. And lots of things happen. It's in the mountains. It's beautiful. Lots of temples, lots of things. But I wrote a whole paper dealing with the problem, a journal article, dealing with the problem of what was going on at Corinth in reference to tongues in light of the religion of Apollo and Dionysius. And knowing that what was happening in Corinth and what was occurring in the church at Corinth and in the community of religion in Corinth, and then looking at what was going on at Delphi, it made a lot of sense that Corinthians were off into all sorts of strange ways of thinking. They had not left some of their pagan ideas outside the church building, which is also so what happens today. So anyway, there's that. I'm going to skip this. This, by the way, is from the synagogue that used to be there in Corinth. These are menorahs. And this actually says in Greek, this says Hebrews. the synagogue of the Hebrews. So Paul the Apostle probably was in that synagogue because he regularly went to the synagogue first, did his best to talk to people that had some background similar to his and argued about Messiah. And then he had a house of a philosopher in Corinth. You realize that? Paul established church at a philosopher's home in Corinth, paid whatever it was. They had church meetings next to the synagogue. So we know about where the local church of Corinth was. This is a Bema seat, the judgment seat that Gallio found Paul innocent of the charges that the Jews, who probably did not like, he went to the synagogue, they didn't like what he had to say, then they tried to get him arrested. Stuff like today. They try to get you arrested and get rid of you being able to say anything. Yeah, they canceled Paul, as it were. They got woke. So this happened, and Paul had that experience. And yet after he was found innocent by Gallio, a pagan, based on the facts, he was in Corinth for a couple of years, you know, doing his work. This, by the way, is what they chained you to when you were there for judgment. If you look at that carefully, there's a little place to put a chain. This is one of our fascinating things from Romans 16:23. This is a church member at the church at Corinth. Okay? This is a Christian who went to the church at Corinth. He was the treasurer of the city, as they call him. There's actually another name for it. But he essentially was in charge of all the public works. Pretty wealthy. And the way they did things in those days when you wanted to be a city official like a mayor, or you wanted to be a governor, some kind of position, you actually took your own funds, you gave and helped the people to do things, you actually built pavements for them, buildings for them, you took your money and provided for the people, and those who did that, then they became city officials. I think we ought to start that one. We have a lot less people running for office, probably. Instead of making money, you gave money. See, that's how they worked it. And so this man in Romans 16:23, it says, Erastus, the treasurer of the city, greets you, and Quartus, a brother. That is a statement from the Apostle Paul regarding an actual person who lived in the 50s at Corinth, who was a Christian, who was a public figure, who built this thing you're looking at right now with his own name on it. And there's a pavement, if you go there, it's a pavement as big as this whole area right here, that he built that, and then this was built by Erastus. Isn't that amazing? Early Christian right there. That's up front a little bit. You could probably figure out some of the stuff there if you look at it, some of the usage of words. This is a isthmus. I'm going to skip over some stuff. I just want to show you quickly, this is Delphi. I'm not going to talk much about it. There's a whole thing I could do on this. But this is a place they ran. This is a track place. You can see the places that were the starting blocks right there up at this top. And this is how beautiful it is around there. It's a gorgeous area. This is the word Gallio, which is found on an inscription found up in Delphi. This is the proconsul that we talked about that let Paul go off. He let him go. Here's a temple to Apollo, who again was the god of Corinth and Delphi. He was the major god. And the oracle at Delphi that you've heard about, she was a prophetess of Apollo. Apollo was a god of wisdom and knowledge. That was his. All these gods had their special talents, you know. So he was a god of wisdom and knowledge. And so she then interpreted people's questions and gave them information and how to act and do. And that's a story all in itself, how that occurs. But now here we are in Athens. Athens, this is Mars Hill, sometimes called the Areopagus, because Eros is in Greek, that's the word for the god of war. In Latin, it came over as Mars. We're most familiar with Mars, probably. But it's Areopagus, the hill of Eros, the god of war. And on top of that, they would actually meet. They had a building built, and that's where they would get and discuss questions philosophically. And that's where they had the trial of Paul, as it were, because he's come speaking strange things. And so he sort of argued his point before these philosophers in Athens. And they had a structure somewhat like this on top of the hill. That's looking from the Areopagus up to the Acropolis. And there's somebody else that kept following me around everywhere, wanted to go places. So I let her stay around. So there in front of the Acropolis. And here is the Parthenon. Get this straight. Pantheon means all the deities. Pan, all, deities, theos. There is a pantheon in Rome, close to the Spanish Steps. It's a round thing. It's called the Pantheon, where all the gods are worshipped. Parthenon refers to a Greek word, parthenos, which means virgin. The Parthenon refers to the virgin Athena, the goddess of wisdom in Athens. Do you understand? And they say that when you were bringing your boats up to Athens, you could actually look into the temple here and see her large, beautiful statue and how she looked standing up. And so it was sort of like this. By the way, in Nashville, Tennessee, if you go to the park there, there is a Parthenon built. And inside you will find Athena still hanging around right there, just sort of like it shows right here. If you've ever been there, they have something like this. But that's the only other Parthenon I know. But this is Parthenon, standing for the goddess Athena of wisdom. There is that person again. Anyway, here we are in the Acropolis in Athens at the top. You have other things up there, like the god Zeus's wife has a place there and others, but they have all these. Now, this right here, I'm moving toward the end. This is Miletus, one of my favorite places, and I try to take my tours there if at all possible, because Miletus has some fascinating things, and the way it fits in with the Bible is that this is the place that Paul, when he was coming back, he said, I can't stop by Ephesus, have the Ephesian elders meet me at Miletus. And they traveled from Ephesus down, about a day's trip, down to Miletus to be there and meet Paul in Miletus. It's got some phenomenal stuff in it. Again, I can just touch the basics here. I even saw something I'd never seen before just last time I was there on the side of a wall I never looked at. That would be fascinating to you. But this right here, I'm in a bath, which is very popular in those days, and there's the god of the bath back in the back. They don't have any water in it now. Nobody uses it. But here's a theater there. Every city has a theater. Another angle. It's a big theater. But one of the things I like about the theater is that they have reserved seating. Yeah. You put your name on it and it's yours. Because we have a word used in the book of Acts repeatedly called God-fearers. Cornelius was called a God-fear. What a God-fear was a Gentile who was, this is before accepting Christ. Cornelius had not accepted Christ when he was called a God-fear. Individuals who were Gentiles, who were attracted to the Jewish religion for many reasons that we could discuss, but they had many reasons why they were attracted, but they were attracted to the Jewish religion when they brought themselves to the synagogue. They never became Jews, but they were called God-fearers. That's important. Some of these God-fearers also came over to Christianity. See, and in large part they did. And what happened is that this actually is inscribed on one of the seating areas of, and I even videoed myself going to find it so I know how to find it again. But there are several places it says topoi this, topoi that. Topoi means place, the place of so-and-so. This one says I can't read it here. It says topoi iudeon ton kai theabesios. That's the Greek. And so the place of the Jews, and then we have an issue grammatically, so we're not quite sure. Then it ends with ton, which means of the. And then it says, also God-fears. So there are a couple of different ways you could translate it. But without going into that question, it clearly says this is the place for the Jews and the God-fears. You understand me? So this is probably individuals that were not pagan in their view of religion. They were either Jews or possibly even converts to Christianity. That's found on the steps. Another picture of it. Another thing you find is this thing here where it says Asiarch. Aarch, well, Tone Asiarch. This is a word, actually it doesn't say, it says arche, Tone Asiarchane. They have found this particular expression several places now in the ancient world. It's a statement for a city official. There's also another word that I'll show you in a minute as I sort of move to the conclusion. Is that the word polytarch. Now, the reason why these are significant is because scholars for many years used to say that these words that are found in the Bible text when it talks about Paul and so forth, that these are made-up words, never occurred in the ancient world. And I always have a little statement. I say, archaeology catches up with the Bible. See, the Bible's correct already, but some guys, if they say, if it existed, I would know it. If it existed, I would have found it. And they just hadn't found it. And all of a sudden they find it and say, okay, what's next? You know, they never really convert much. They just sort of still become, they still stay skeptical of it. But they have found now arche, this word, or Asiarch, I should say. They found this several places in the ancient world. And they've also found this word here, which is the word polytarch. And this is a word, again, where Paul was being given a lot of trouble at Thessalonica, I guess. And people were yelling and screaming and so forth and so on. And one of the city fathers, who was called a polytarch. This word was not found until a few years ago, but it was in the biblical text. All I'm saying, again, archaeology catches up with the Bible. Because the Bible's correct, but you just got to sometimes wait until you dig the right place. Okay, this is one of the fascinating things. This is the area of Berea. We don't have much there. But it's significant in this text that when the Jews found out that Paul got off in Thessalonica, they came down to Berea to cause troubles. But it says here, of these, he said that you have a group of these. Paul went to, he says, they heard the word of God eagerly. And they searched the scripture to see whether it was so. And many embrace the faith. And that's really a great thing to see here, the place that all happened. Well, I'm just going to show you the pictures next and not say much. That's where Paul was judged by the people in Rome. That's a theater in Caesarea by the sea. Paul was probably there in a jail. That's Herod's bathing pool in his palace. Nice place, right on the coast. And this is the Hippodrome, the place for the horse races. That's where the riot against Rome began in AD 66, where the actual thing that brought on the fall of Jerusalem started right there where you're looking. Huh? In Israel. I'm sorry. Yes, we're in Israel. But I said Caesarea. I thought probably people know. Caesarea Maritima. And this is the side way of the Aegean Sea that comes out of the Mediterranean Sea, actually, not the Aegean Sea. And the hippodrome is on there, and over here is the place. This is where the Pilate inscription was found. I'm going to pass over all this. I talked about this earlier. I'll just show it to you. Here's where those massive things that were cleaved in two fell. Look what it did when it fell. It just dented it all in. And like here. That comes from the things falling from above when they destroyed the temple. Well, that's it. I covered as much as I could with the time, and I've gone over. I know a lot. I apologize. But you told me last time to go ahead and go and do it. So hope this helps to get some perspective. Isn't the Bible an interesting book? I would hate to be some religion that has all sorts of, they say things occurred and there's no evidence. The Bible is just full of it. I mean, I could go on for hours here on things. Again, there's been 10,000 findings that directly connect with the biblical text in archaeology so far. That's amazing. Other groups can't find one. So you know what I'm talking about, but I'm staying nice. So I hope this helped. Assuming that I teach again, I will finish my last section, which will not take near as long. This was covering a lot. The last one will be on the seven churches of Asia, archaeology, and the Apostle John, the Revelation. And we'll look at the seven churches and see what's there. It's pretty cool. So, should I just end in prayer? Okay. Lord, we just thank you for all your blessings you bring to us all the time. And I'm so thankful, Lord, and I know others here today are the same, that you have given us your revelation in written form that we can keep and read and reread and learn and study and appreciate more what you did in human history and even recognize that you haven't finished, but you're working in our history too, in our lives and helping us. So, God, help us to understand better what you have to say. Help us to appreciate you more for who you are. And, Lord, thank you for Jesus who gave himself for us. And we pray in his name.